You're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And this evening, I've got a special guest, John DeCamp. And I want to say that listening to Truth Quest, we're streamed on the internet at khen.org. And Truth Quest programs are archived at www.givemesometruth.info. And I want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and are my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. But I'm going to go right on into this interview because I think we've got a great program ahead. If got you there, John?
I am indeed here.
Okay, great. And John, when I went to print out your bio, it's another one of those lengthy ones that I think I couldn't do you justice just by stating a little summary here. I think it's better for people to let you tell a little bit of yourself because there's a whole lot there that people need to know.
Well, let's see. I'm an old man. Once upon a time, I used to think 70, when I was a kid, 70 was, when you're ready to be planted in the ground and so on and so forth. Now I'm just going to be 70 in a couple months, and it seems I'm not quite ready for that, being planted or anything. So, still active. I started out like so many others, young guy, and ended up kind of on my own when I was about 14 and so on. And was the youngest of eight kids. My family kind of fragmented. I ended up on my own then and got put in an institution for a while and got out of there and went hitchhiking about 16 and ended up getting a job on a Dutch freighter. Back in those days, freighters took passengers a lot, and they had to have a cabin boy, so I was a cabin boy. And did that for a while until I ended up in Karamsher, which is a port in the Persian Gulf, in what's now Iran, of course. And got a job there and learned more working there in Persia, Iran, I guess we call it now, than I guess I learned in just about everything I've ever done in life. I was there for a couple of years and then came back and took a test and they let me into the university and I was a good boy and studied hard and did pretty good in college and went on through law school, got a doctorate of law and then got this letter from a guy named Uncle Sammy. And Uncle Sammy said, "Hey, John, we got us a war going and we'd like you to join us." And I thought, not that interested in getting in wars these days, but Uncle Sammy said, "And you better come, or we'll have to send you somebody to get you. So I reported, and there was this guy named Richard Nixon, and he was running for president back about that time, and he said, well, now if you elect me, this war will all be over, this Vietnam War. So I thought, well, all I have to do is kind of stall a little and buy a little time, but the only way to stall was if you were in special schools. So I volunteered one after another for officer school, then jungle school, then airborne ranger. Vietnamese language was the last one. And guess what they do with somebody who's crazy enough to run through the jungle, jump out of airplanes, speaks Vietnamese, and is an officer? Why, they send him directly to a place called Vietnam. And so I ended up in the war there as a captain, and did something kind of unusual in my last months of my serving. I was in an officer's club one night. We were kind of maybe having a toddy or two and talking, and I made some remark about, it seems this is kind of crazy here. We're not allowed to win. We're not allowed to lose. We're just kind of going in circles. And the other officers sitting at the table, they said, DeCamp, we all know that, but shut your mouth or you'll end up in the brig. And I said, well, maybe one of us should say something about it. And they said, yeah, well, you do it. We ain't going to say anything. We're just going to serve our time and get home. So just for the heck of it, because I kind of like to follow politics, I sent some papers into the Secretary of State and said, you know, I'd kind of like to run for senator. And next thing I know, I'm reading the Stars and Stripes newspaper, and there on the front page is about this crazy captain over in Vietnam who's running for senator while he's serving in the war. So, make a long story short, I ended up being, I think, the first and last one in the history of the country that ever became a senator without setting foot in the country in the United States. Won it by sending all kinds of mail. You know, soldiers who were in combat could send their mail by writing free on the envelope. I don't know if you knew that, no. But anyway, so I got tens and thousands of envelopes and letters and got them printed up with my message and sent them over there. Had some kids over there put the addresses on and send them and put free on them, and the Army tried to stop me from doing that because I was kind of critical of some of the aspects of the war in my letter. But anyway, to make a long, long story short, ended up winning the election and became a Nebraska senator and took office literally on the day I got back from Vietnam, and served as a senator here in Nebraska for 16 years and was, I thought, pretty effective and very well known and very controversial. And after I got out, I took up my law practice and was pretty active that way. I've been a lawyer now for, 40-some years or something, anyway. And learned a lot and did a lot and had a lot of interesting cases over the years, from Columbine kids I represented to grand jurors in the Oklahoma bombing and on and on and on. Anyway, now I still have a law practice here in Nebraska, as you know, about 17, 18, 20 years ago, whatever it was, got involved in this crazy Franklin thing and wrote a book about it. And I've been pretty active. And
you've definitely covered a lot of controversial or well-known cases. And with this Franklin cover-up, that's the one thing I've been listening to a lot of hours of some of the interviews between you and Ted Gunderson and Jim Rothstein and Noreen Gosch.
You've probably heard them more often than I have. I did them, but a long time ago. Hey, one other thing I forgot to mention, not to brag, but I got to tell you. So anyway, then, after I'd been a senator for about 5 years, the Vietnam War was finally coming to an end, and I remembered a young lady I left behind there that I always kept never forgetting, and excused myself from the Nebraska Senate and jumped on an airplane and said, I'm going back to Vietnam, see if I can find her. I got back there, and the ambassador, I went to see him and told him what I wanted, if he could use any of his team in the Mekong Delta to contact this young lady. And he said, well, maybe if you do me a favor, I could do you one. I says, okay, I don't know what I can do. He says, well, he says, you know, the American people are divided on this issue of whether we should send the B-52 bombers back against the North and whether we should get the troops back in here and try to win this war, or whether we should just walk away. And he says, back in World War II, the American public was also kind of isolationist and didn't want to get involved. But then when they started bringing those children from London, where they were doing the Blitz bombings and stuff, bringing them to America for safety, he says, American people start finally getting interested, and you know, the rest is history. We got very actively into the war, and then, so on and so forth. And he says, we've got several thousand half-American, half-Vietnamese kids that are in the orphanages here, and the orphanages are being abandoned. The kids are just going to end up anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, would you take out a load? And I says, well, yeah, I don't have any airplanes or anything. But he says, oh, we'll arrange all that. We just need you to lead the effort and organize and get the kids there and get them back anyway. So I did it. And by the time we got to the United States with that first load, I only had 34 kids in the first load. It was getting world attention and publicity. And so the State Department called me and asked me if I'd make another trip. This time I went back and put 834 kids on the airplane.
Wow.
Using a C-5A cargo plane, you know. They just strapped them in one after another, got back, and these kids are all been adopted and are happy. And I made another trip then, and so on and so forth. Anyway, when it was all said and done, it was called Operation Baby Lift. And I got about 2,834 half-American, mostly half-Vietnamese kids back here and adopted rapidly, and I still get letters from them. And then I got brought to the White House, and the president decorated me as one of the 8 most outstanding veterans of the Vietnam War. So I guess I learned something there. But anyway, it's been an interesting life.
So did you marry the lady that you went over to find?
And the little girl, he did exactly what he promised. He located her, got her out, and she's now the best wife in the world, mother of my 4 kids. Their youngest one's now 22 and grown up, but she is the most perfect little wife and mother on this planet Earth.
Well,
Does that answer your question?
She must have been the one that answered the phone when I called earlier today. I could tell she had an accent. So
could you tell she was Asian by her?
She doesn't have a strong accent, but I could tell.
No, not her. But she, you know, kind mm-hmm. of the words.
Right.
You want to talk to John? You
know? Yes.
I better be careful. I get hit.
So
anyway, what can we do for you?
Well, what I was going to ask is what you wrote the book about is called The Franklin Cover-Up.
Yes.
And this is where you got some of your most significant notoriety, correct?
Yes.
And so why don't you tell us a little about that and while you're doing that, I just have to commend you for, you know, following through on this, because I've been following this case for a while, even though I got in as just within the last few years, but it's just amazing, you know, the tenacity it takes to to pick up something like this and go with it. And so go ahead and explain to the audience, you know,
what you
did.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. It'll kind of rock you. When these stories started coming out, it started when back then a lot of credit and banks and so on and so forth were failing, you know, if you remember.
Right.
Anyway, and one of them called the Franklin Credit Union in Nebraska went belly up, and the feds came in to check it out, and they found $40 million missing. And there was a black man, a young black man named Larry King, not the Larry King famous on television, but Larry King was his name, and he was, he'd been on the cover of one of the magazines as the fastest rising black star in the Republican Party. And when they started investigating, as I say, they found $40+ million missing, and stories started floating on the street at the same time. And I had left the Senate by that time. When I was there, I was chairman of banking, commerce, and insurance, so I had more than a passing interest in the SNLs, because I had helped bail out some of them, when these stories came out, they were about from kids, and kids were talking about, well, they knew Larry King. They used to fly in his private jet and go to places like New York and Washington, and the stories got more horrid and scary and unbelievable about the kids talking about being taken here, being taken there, and treated like royalty and getting anything they wanted, and then providing sex for different people. They'd be taken to parties, special parties, and at what they called the after parties, and they would be lined up or teamed up with this or that particular individual, or particularly some pretty prominent politicians and businessmen and so on and so forth. And I was one of the first, when I was asked about it, to hearing these rumors on the street, to say, oh, this has to be fantasy land. I said, if I really believed any of it, I'd be the first one to come forward and try to do something about it. But I said, you know, this this is just getting too wild and crazy. And I got a letter then from a kid in jail. His name was Paul Benassi, he said. And he said, I got locked up on the same night they arrested Larry King and came here. And he said, I'm one of those kids, and all I did was, he said, touched my cousin on the outside of his pants in a sensitive place. But he says, they're trying to accuse me of doing something when the real stuff I did, they don't want me talking about at all. And he said, I know you don't believe these things, Mr. DeCamp, because I read in the paper you said this has to be all fantasy. But you said if you really believed it, you'd try to do something about it. And he said, if you'd come and see me, I could prove it to you. Well, I thought the kid's calling my bluff. His name was Paul Benassi, as I say. And so I thought, what the heck? I've got to put my actions where my mouth was when I said this is all fantasy and whatever. So I went over to Omaha where they had him locked up in jail. And sure enough, as I was walking in, this fairly prominent, fairly famous psychiatrist named Beverly Mead, as I recall his name, he was coming out, and I said, oh, hi, Doc, you know, blah, 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 because he was head of a psychiatric institute in the college and university or something. Anyway, and I said, what are you doing here? And he says, well, I guess I just found out I've been talking to the same person that you're apparently going to see, Mr. Benassi, young man, right? I said, yeah, how'd you know? He says, oh, the kid mentioned to me that you said you wrote him and said you'd come see him. And so I said, what are you doing? He says, well, I just was examining him at the instruction of the law enforcement to see if he's crazy or not. And I said, oh, he's crazy, right? And the psychiatrist kind of surprised me. He said, no. I said, well, you don't think he's telling the truth, do you, on this stuff? And he says, not only is he telling the truth, he's incapable of not telling the truth. He's a multiple personality. And when confronted, he doesn't lie. He just switches personality, and that other personality answers it. I didn't know what he was babbling about when he was talking about multiple personalities and all this. But anyway, so I said, oh, well, so you think he's telling the truth? And he said, absolutely, I think so. I said, okay, well, I'll go see him. So I go in, and I get talking to the kid, and I noticed he was kind of unusual, but anyway. And he told me, I know you don't believe me, he says, but if you'd go to this house at a certain address he gave me, and the window well outside, you know, the house, those window wells, you know, or for like basement windows and so on and so forth, he says, I have buried my diaries I always kept there. And he says, ever since I was little, I maintain diaries of everything, and I've written my whole story in those, and they're buried there, and if you go there, you can get them. And I thought, oh, God, this has to really get to be fantasy land now. But anyway, I decided, what the heck, I'll go check it out, because the psychiatrist had said, well, you know, multiple personality doesn't have to lie. They tell the truth because they just switch personalities. So I go to this house, which, by the way, was kind of an abandoned house by that time, and sure enough, I went to the window well and dug down a little bit, and sure enough, there were these books, and the kid had told me that they were there, and he had kept them because he said his grandfather, when he was just a little boy, taught him and instructed him and helped him learn to keep a diary of everything he does and everything that's happening in his life and so on and so forth. So the kid said that's what he'd done ever since he was just 6 or 7 years old. And he was now, what, I guess he must have been about 16 there in jail when I went to see him. And so I got the diaries, and I thought, well, as I started reading them, one name after another, prominent individual, and dates and times and places and trips to Washington, and just unbelievable. And I thought, I wonder if these are even made in the year when they supposedly show this activity occurring, like on this date and this date. So I took them to scientists who know how to check these things and how to identify. They can tell the age of the ink and the age of this paper and when this writing tool was invented or used, as opposed to something else, like on pens and ballpoint pens. I never understood it all, but they come back with a report to me that they're absolutely satisfied the diaries, at least, were written on the time and period and blah, blah, blah. And so I started thinking, well, I guess the kids kind of called my bluff. I better put my money where my mouth is and my actions where my tongue was. And so I agreed to try to help the kid, and that opened the door to the most frightening years of my life, and on and on and on. But out of it came this book and a lot of exposure of some of the most horrible things going on with child abuse and use of young kids and prominent folk and others. Anyway, so I got my friend from Vietnam involved. I asked the Senate committee that was investigating this to hire him because his name was Bill Colby, and you may remember him. He had been the head of the Central Intelligence Agency after Vietnam. He was officially deputy ambassador there, and he was the one I worked for. When I went to Vietnam, I was assigned to him in something called the Phoenix Program, which I'm ashamed to say today I was deeply involved in. But
what is the Phoenix Program?
Well, it had good intentions. Bill Colby created it. So I'm sure some people listening will get angry when I say this, but what the idea of it was, instead of you know, just bombing villages or killing too many people or whatever, send the team into individual villages or places and identify who the key leaders were there, and then I'll then go in and sneak in later and kill them. You get the idea?
Yeah. But anyway. I mean, this is key information to know, I would say, because I think that's something to know these days. But go ahead.
Well, that's what I did over there. I had a team, and I had a counterpart who was a Vietnamese colonel, and we had anyway. So that's what I did over there, and I got to know Bill pretty well. And then after I got to be a senator, he was the one, by the way, that stopped the Army from giving me all kinds of trouble when I decided over there in Vietnam to run for senator. And he backed me, which kind of upset the military, but he was a kingpin there. I think he was probably head of the CIA then, because he left there and ended up as head of the CIA. But anyway, and so... where were we? I got to know him, so I had them hire him. By then, he'd been fired from the CIA, maybe one of the only firings they've had, even though he was head of the CIA, Nixon, and Kissinger. Kissinger officially fired him because he was starting to, I guess, investigate things they didn't like or bring out things that made some people unhappy. And... So then he set up his own private investigative agency, so I got them to hire him, the Senate committee, to start looking into this thing about Franklin and all the stories coming out of there and the involvement of the kids. And
this Franklin Credit Union, was it going on when they had the other credit unions like the Silverado and all that? Oh, okay. All right.
Exactly. Do you remember... I think one of Bush's kids, in fact.
Right, Neil Bush, yes.
Neil Bush had a couple out in Colorado, as I recall.
Right.
Or something. Anyway, yes, same time. When they had a whole bunch of these things going on and a lot of naughty things occurring in terms of what was causing them. Some people forgot that money wasn't theirs. It belonged to the people that put it there, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so Bill got involved advising the Senate committee, and I got involved representing the kid, and I guess the rest is history. Eventually, I won that boy in a messy, messy, painful, horrible trial. I won him $1 million, which unfortunately he's never been able to get because Larry King ended up in prison, and I don't even know where he is anymore, but... His money all disappeared, wherever he had it. And I got involved in helping some of the other kids, and on and on and on. It was crazy. And as I say, bringing out the names of some very prominent people involved and exposing something that, as I say, I didn't even believe existed when I first started hearing about it, but is pretty prevalent in certain...
Well, when you do any reading and looking into this, I mean, it's like a spider web. It goes in so many different directions, and you find so many different names. You what?
I say that's a very good description, spider web. Just every time I thought it was just an isolated thing, it would lead to all kinds of things, and God, I ended up going all over the United States following up on things, and... trying to help different kids and get some other people involved. Mr. Gunderson, you've heard of him, right?
Yeah, I've got him scheduled and Jim Rothstein both to come up here.
Oh, yeah. Well, so. Both of them. It's interesting. Gunderson came to Nebraska, I think, originally to... he had been second in command of the FBI, you know, and had retired. And was now just doing some private investigating for issues he selected or whatever. And he came to Nebraska, I think, originally to kind of investigate me after I got so active in this and started getting all the publicity and saying and what I think is exposing things. And I think... I've always wondered, because I think when he first came there, he thought I was going to try to withhold information or something. And I just did the opposite. I said, hey, you can use my office. Here's my files. Here's what I'm finding, and I find it difficult to believe also. So to my surprise and shock, and I think 10 times more shock for him, I just let him use my office and have a little space anytime he wanted there, and he became deeply involved and ultimately ended up as my closest friend, and believe it or not, moved to Nebraska and lived here a couple of years. Rented a house even after my book came out and everything. So it's been interesting and scary and dangerous, because some of the folk involved don't take lightly people trying to catch him, destroying him, embarrass him, whatever. And I had warned him and told him when he got involved in this, I said, I know you know a lot more about this than I will in 1,000 years, but be careful, because there's some people threatened my family and kids and tried to send signals and on and on and on. Sure enough, it happened to him several times, and he became my strongest supporter, as I say, and lived here then and really got deeply involved in this. It's a crazy world.
The more I look around this particular subject, it ties into so many different areas, and like I was saying, the tentacles just reach out.
Let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. One of the key individuals that the boy identified, as did other children too, one of the key individuals that some of the, quote, parties and getting the benefits of these children, you know what I mean,
mm-hmm.
was a guy named Robert Wadman, who was also the police chief of Omaha, the biggest city in this state. And after my first book came out, he ended up losing his job here. And then he went to another place and North Carolina or somewhere, and
right,
and sued me for libel and slander and what all, and that was, God, I don't know, maybe 15, 18 years ago or whatever, and I won that case, and then he sued me in another state, and I won that case, and then I thought it was finally done. He sued me in Ogden, Utah. I don't know if you know where Ogden, Utah
is. Yeah, I
do. Because I didn't know that much about it. But Ogden, Utah is kind of central headquarters of Mormonism, you know, the Mormon Church.
Right.
And he got a job there and lost his law enforcement job there after the book got around. And then he now is teaching in the college there in Ogden, Utah. What do they call it? Weber College? You know what I'm talking about?
No, I'm not sure.
Anyway, it's the Mormon college there.
Mm-hmm.
And he sued me there here about, it's been a year and a half ago now. And had a trial, messy and tough as it was, right out there, where he was the most beloved person I think there was in the town. And when the judge came back, and I brought in people from all over the United States, and we had the trial, and I can still remember the judge coming in to render his decision. He starts out saying how wonderful Bob Wadman was and how much he respected him and everything. And I thought, he's just going to shove it up anyway. And then he says, but I have no choice. The senator from Nebraska has proved his case. I have no choice but to rule in his favor and dismiss your lawsuit, Mr. Wadman, you know. And so that's kind of rocked and shocked me, because everything that you could mention in terms of odds and whatever was against me, but the judge was ultimately honest and ruled right. And then Mr. Wadman appealed that one, too, and he lost that one. So it ain't like I haven't been through hell, so to speak, for writing the book, but I was warned at the time I did it that you're playing with fire, and sure enough, it's been fire, but I think the book has done a lot to help educate some people around the country as to this problem, and I think a lot of good's come of it. And
well, can you? Is that book still available?
Oh, yes. Well, the answer is yes and no. I have to get a new printing, and I think I'll update it. I think I've still got some books left. It used to be the first edition, and I think the second edition were in just literally every bookstore in the country, and they sold hundreds of thousands of copies. I never spent one penny promoting, advertising, anything on a book. I just printed it myself, wrote it myself, got it printed, you know, and it caught on in the bookstores. And then this latest edition, I'm still trying to figure out what the story is there. I go into the bookstores because I noticed it wasn't in bookstores anymore. It was being pulled out. And the bookstore, I said, can you get me that book? And the clerk said, well, it's out of print. It's out of print. I said, it is not. Here's the new edition. So we kept checking, and over a period of time, I found out apparently with my new edition, they said I didn't put the right ISBN number. I had to add a new number because I had changed things in the book, added additional input, you know, like a patent or copyright. And so now I'm going to get that corrected and write a few editions and get it back in the bookstores. But we sold tens of thousands then right out of my office, and you can still get it on Amazon.com. In fact, crazy as this sounds, I don't understand all that computer stuff, but you can go on Amazon, you know, and some people are paying 50, 60, and 80 bucks for the crazy book to getting it through Amazon, whereas, of course, I sell it to the bookstores for, what, $7?
So do you still have copies then?
I have some copies at my house, or I mean in my office in Lincoln, and so for the last 2 years or so, every day I've been going to get the new edition out and get the corrected ISBN number and all that stuff, and but I still haven't got it done. But so I still got some copies, and we get calls all the day at the office, and they send them out just individually, or you can go on Amazon.com and people sell used copies.
Okay, and, okay, I'm speaking with John DeCamp, who wrote the book, The Franklin Cover-Up. And so do they just type in John DeCamp on the internet and they can find a way to...
Yeah, that'll do it. Just John DeCamp, Nebraska, or John DeCamp, Senator John DeCamp, whatever you want.
Now, I did do an interview...
You just do a jillion things there.
I did an interview earlier in the summer with Nick Bryant, who came in and wrote it.
Okay, that's the one that wrote that book. I was saying the Franklin... His new book came out here, what, within the last year or something?
Yeah, I think his was...
Called The Franklin Scandal. And as I say, I thought he came here, he sure was acting that way at the start when he came here, to disprove it and kind of make a fool of me. In fact, he did the opposite ultimately. I just turned the office over to him where I had my files and let him go through anything and everything. And he learned a lot, and he basically effectively dedicated the book to me. And made me the hero of the book, which kind of shocked and surprised me, because he spent about 7 years working on it, and he can tell you better than I can some of the threats that happened, because I had warned him. I said, hey, you know, the folk you're playing with on this thing really take this serious, and I said, I didn't believe it either, but it's happened in many ways. And Gunderson, did he tell you about his incident?
No, I haven't interviewed him yet, but I'm going
to... Oh, okay. You ask him. He borrowed my new truck. He had to go to Omaha, from Lincoln to Omaha. It's about 60 miles or something. He had to go to pick up somebody or go to the airport or something. And the wheels came off of his truck.
Uh-huh.
A nice new truck. And it was obvious it had been tampered with or whatever. And he was a good enough driver. He survived it. And, of course, I got upset because he was messing up my truck. But anyway, he can tell you the story in detail. But if he had any doubts, he didn't after that incident, because when they checked, they found enough stuff that was obviously the wheel nuts or whatever they're called were loosened, so that I'm wondering if somebody thought I was going to be driving it, because I had just gotten it, and then he wanted to borrow something to go to Omaha after he, anyway, and that's what happened.
Now, I there's some really good lengthy interviews on the internet, besides the one that the conspiracy of silence, is that the...
Okay, conspiracy of silence, that's another interesting one. That was a British film team that was hired by Discovery Channel. You know Discovery Channel?
Uh-huh.
To do a documentary on it. And they also came in kind of going to prove the opposite of what I was claiming. And once again, they really spent the money and went into depth. And basically gained additional information even that I didn't have, documenting and proving what I claimed was there. They called it Conspiracy of Silence. And it was aired once on the East Coast on Discovery Channel. It had been advertised all over the United States in the magazines, in the guides in the newspapers, you know, that have the time of race was to air on the Discovery Channel. As soon as it aired, just in like the East Coast in New York, whatever, it got pulled off the air. And all I know is I got a copy, and I can't tell you where, how, or when, but I got a copy, let's say, from over in England, and this was a British, English investigative team that was here doing this documentary, and so we printed up copies, and I just was giving a lot of them away and selling some, because it got taken off the air right after it had aired on the East Coast. And what I learned was apparently it may have been deeply, bigly involved in a trade between the Congress or certain prominent congressmen and legislation that was going on at the time I can't even remember exactly what it was, but legislation that the TV industry did not want to get passed because it would have limited them. And so the understanding, as I understand it, was pull this off the air and we'll vote to protect you, and so on. So anyway, it's been a strange life since I got involved.
Luckily that there's the internet, you could still at least watch it, though, to see what...
I understand that, and millions of people have, and it was quite a deal, yeah.
Yeah, Alex Merklinger did a week-long series, I guess, between you and Jim Rothstein and Ted Gunderson and you and Noreen Gosh, and was it Randy or Rusty?
Rusty Nelson.
Nelson, right. Yes, and now, go ahead.
He ended up being an individual that turned out to be most beneficial, and I helped and kind of helped get him protected. He was one of the ones that had key evidence that made the claims of the kids, and of course my writing about them and explaining them, proved them. He had been a photographer for these powerful, prominent individuals. He had been a photographer for them at these parties, and you know, mm-hmm. and taking interesting pictures, let's put it that way.
Well,
and Rusty, provided me tons of information, and in fact, lived in my office for a while he was making himself safe.
Now, is he in jail or is he out?
He's out now.
Okay. But It seems
he had tons of stuff. He gave me some, and he had a whole bunch more, and it got taken, unfortunately.
Well, there was one in one of that interview, I guess, with, I believe it was that interview with Alex Merklinger from Mysteries of the Mind or whatever. They were describing some of the places that he supposedly had the film or pictures stored or whatever, and some of them may have been in Colorado. Is that
Colorado,
right?
And also, what was that? Oregon.
Oregon?
Yeah, because I went out there to, oh God, this is so complicated. I'm starting to remember all these things and I haven't put them on the side. But I went out there and ended up defending him in what they were trying to lock him up for there.
Well, they have a tendency to discredit people heavily, you know, that seem to get involved with coming forth bringing information.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Discredit, make them crazy. And so, let me think here just a minute. So I went out there. Oh, and the police had seized all these pictures. That's it. And from a vehicle, and I gained access to them, and I then tried to get them released or make them available again, and somehow or other, they all got disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is with the police in possession of them. And I saw just enough to make sure, so I started filing things, and they ended up disappearing.
Well, I mean, are you pretty much uncovered when you were doing this investigation that this did, I mean, there were a lot of law enforcement involved in this, FBI.
Yeah, they were used. Yeah, there were a lot of them, unfortunately. See, these kids were being used by a lot of folk for two things. One was carrying drugs, like on airplanes or from one location or another. The last person
couriers
back in those days that was going to be checked and would be thought to be carrying loads of, amphetamines or cocaine or something is a 10 or 12 or whatever-year-old kid, right? And so they go somewhere and they, anyway, it just is nuts. And I know it sounds unbelievable, and probably people listening, I don't know, where are you out of?
Out of Salida, Colorado.
Oh, you're in Colorado.
Right.
Oh, okay. Well, you remember Columbine, don't you?
Oh, yeah, well, I was going to get into that one, too.
Anyway, so I forgot what I was saying, but
well, they were the kids were being used as couriers, and
oh, yeah. What better, safer way to get your drugs transported than have a 10, 12-year-old kid? And that was before they had all the searching like they do now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty routine as long as you didn't have a glaring gun on you or something. And, it was most interesting.
Well, there's several things. I mean, again, this is like, there's so many directions you can go with this, but
yes,
why it's so important to really continue to look at this, and I find it amazing that you still are, because I'm sure it has to be frustrating and realizing that, you know,
well,
there has nothing is done about it.
The wife and kids had some horrible incidents happen, too. Just I'll give you one example. My oldest daughter, she was probably, I'm going to say she must have been about 10. Anyway, these three guys come driving into the yard. I wasn't there, but I had a real, real big, nice yard in Lincoln, Nebraska, right on one of the real nice streets there. And they come in and grab her little dog, and I didn't see it. She described it, though. Anyway, and then they put the dog under the wheel of the car, drove over it, backed over it a time or two, then told her, you tell your father this is what can happen to one of you kids if he doesn't back off. And they apparently pounded it into her just exactly the lines to recite.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was one of the incidents that made my wife and everybody want me to get out of it completely. And I thought about doing that, but I was so deep in it by that time that I had to keep plowing ahead for safety, as Bill Colby told me. He was helping me greatly at that time. As I say, he used to be the head of the CIA, you know. And in fact, he was the one that absolutely insisted I write a book and tell everything I knew in there. He said, that is your best defense, your best insurance to protect you and your family. Tell everything you know and make it public, so whether anybody believes anything at all, there's no percentage in doing something to you to give it more credibility. And so that's what inspired the book. And
did he ever
wrote it.
Did he write a book?
He had worked on one, and I don't know whether his book ever came out on that, because he ended up having a strange death, which I believe, as much as I believe anything on the entire earth, because he had been warned, and was the cause of this. You got to understand the guy a little bit. He was the most meticulous, organized, perfect individual when it came to everything there is, you know. Everything was in a line. Everything was
type
perfect.
A.
And so supposedly, and I'd been to his kind of vacation lodge out on, where was it, Chesapeake Bay. I'd been there more than a few times with him, and he liked sailing, but he would never dream of going sailing unless it was the right time of day. And anyway, so supposedly he walks out of his house about supper time, leaves his food on his table, and gets in his sailboat and goes out and falls over. And then they find him about, I don't know whether it was 4 days or 8 days later, and of course, dead, floating there. And the rest is history, but I have no doubt why he died. One of the things that the British Broadcasting Group insisted on when they did this documentary was they would not finish it, they would not do it unless Colby himself would personally go on camera, and they filmed him, would go on camera and say that yes, he knew about it, yes, he had been investigating, yes, he believed what everything I was saying was true. So he finally did it, went on camera, and as I say, that's still in that film that a lot of people still get off the internet. And I got, after they pulled it immediately from television, after it showed on the East Coast, then, as I say, he made sure that he went on on camera with them, and they have that right in their film to prove the validity of it.
Now, did he live? I mean, how soon after that did he drown or whatever? Somewhere, I think in one of the interviews, I thought Ted Gunderson said he was shot.
Ted may know something. Ted had secret information I don't have. As I say, Ted was second in command of the FBI, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the official word on Colby is, well, he must have fallen out of his boat and drowned. And nobody believes that in 100 years. If you knew Colby, he'd never have been out in his boat at that time. He'd never walk out without the proper attire or anything and leave all his dinner, not even eaten, but cooked and there on the table. It just makes no sense.
And in fact, I thought somewhere he said that they might have been tortured or something.
Very possible. I do not know. I admit I don't know. I know what I believe. Nothing fits, and he had been warned anyway.
Yeah, but I guess my question was, is do you think how soon after he did that BBC film Did he live much longer after that, or do you think that's even relevant?
Not too long, not after it came out on, was shown for the first time on television.
Uh-huh.
On the Discovery Channel. That showed him saying, being interviewed and saying, yes, I believe, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see the things proven and established with more evidence, but anyway.
Well, I mean, this ties into, you know, it tied into Boys Town and ties into a huge trafficking ring. I mean, it's an international trafficking ring, isn't it?
Yes, yes. As I say, I could explain a million different things, but maybe just get the book and read it, and there's more going to be coming out, I'm sure.
Right.
I'm going to update my book. Not going to take anything out of it. I'm going to add to it and get a new edition out, I hope, within the next 2-3 months. But anyway.
Well, but why I feel this is, you know, so significant. I mean, there's some things that just kind of, I can't remember who was doing the interview, but just talking about getting this kind of information out there and educating kids, because there's certain things that were taking place with Johnny Gosch and how they were targeting paper boys.
Yep.
And picking.
Kind of funny, you know, Noreen Gosch, out of that whole thing, became probably my strongest supporter and best friend in the world because I found out what had happened to her kid. You know, he was the first one on the milk cartons, the missing children. He was the first one that set that precedent. They used to have the missing children on the milk cartons. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, he was the number one to start that. His mother and got it organized and started it. And I take credit for being the one to finally find what happened to him and give her the proof. And she's, anyway, you might interview her sometime.
Yeah, well, I have every intention of doing that. I just need to get her contact information and I'll certainly follow that up because I've.
Well, if you have to call my office, we can give you the numbers.
Okay.
Okay.
I'd very much like to because this sort of thing.
So frequently.
Uh huh.
I'm going to make one final point, and then I'm probably going to let you go. Maybe we can do another hour another day. Is that okay?
Okay.
Anyway, one of the things I started discovering with surprising regularity or repeat of this, they say, well, how could they get these kids? What are the parents doing? Well, one after another, I found out so frequently a parent gets compromised themselves. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then the parent was promised, well, your kid won't be hurt and anything, and he'll be well taken care of, and blah, blah, blah. But the parent got compromised and knew that they'd end up in jail if they started complaining or anything.
Uh-huh.
And anyway.
So, in other words, they'd get kind of compromised.
You had the credibility. Even get more on this if you read my book, but one of the key things that kept coming out from so many kids and people as not just from me, as these things developed was so often there would be a very clear pattern of some government even involved.
Right, right. it sounds like to me
and then
go ahead.
When I confronted Bill on this, he flat looked at me and he said, you have to understand the situation. And I says, well, you tell me. I said, "Is because the CIA supposedly was involved in some of this themselves. And he says, I have to explain the situation. He says, you're too young to remember, but the Korean War. In the Korean War, our troops were finding repeatedly that they were capturing and brainwashing soldiers. I said, what do you mean brainwashing? He said, you know, literally making them mentally controlled by one system or another, or some person or another. He said, we believe they had developed certain abilities so that they could have, let's say, a soldier standing in front of the President of the United States and reading his mind. He said, well, we found out that's ridiculous, but at least I'll tell you one thing, he said, and this had been developed by the Red Chinese, see, this brainwashing and all this, and then effectively is creating a multiple personality, which Bonassi was, and I think still is. But anyway, and he says, you have to understand that we believed and feared that with that kind of ability, they pose more of a danger to the country than an army. And he says, and I'll tell you one other thing, John. We were never behind. We were never behind. So he says, we learned, we found out what they were doing, how much could be done. And he says, we were never behind. And he says, and yes, I'm sure there were certain abuses done and certain individuals who had been trained and learned about this were involved in working on it, but then went off on their own and abused it or whatever. So you hear of MK Ultra and things like that, I'm
right.
Sure.
Yeah, no, that's what I definitely started seeing, the trail leading there, and that is very chilling, let alone the fact of, you know, just getting into various institutions. And,
yeah. Well, I'm going to run, but as I say, my first reaction when, and hell, I'd been in the Army, I'd been at war, I'd been in the Senate and everything else when this started coming out. I've been through all that, and I still couldn't believe any of it, and I still have difficulty today, even though I've lived it, seen it, observed it, written about it, had to prove it in court several times. It's a crazy, crazy world out there, and sometimes the most impossible, unbelievable things are the ones that are the truest. And I hope that people get on aware of this and know to at least be careful to guard against it if they see the wrong symptoms.
Okay,
somewhere.
But let me get just one more thing from you, because you did bring up the Columbine thing. And one of the things that seemed to have come out that I've seen as an undercurrent out of the Columbine thing, situation, that there was some sort of mind control going on. And did you run into that in the Columbine incident?
We'll talk about Columbine another day.
Okay.
I wrote about Columbine a little bit in the book.
Okay.
Just as an update on some stuff I'd been involved in.
Okay.
And I'll just leave it for another day.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming on the program and getting started on something that I want to do a little more work with here, with doing some interviews with these other gentlemen, and hopefully Noreen Gosh. So, because I do feel that there's a whole this subject really needs to be worked on, because it keeps coming back. If we don't become aware of it, it's just going to never go away. And
I repeat, I would have never believed it, and I would guess a huge portion of your audience right now thinks I'm crazy and this is all fantasy land.
And we didn't even hardly scratch the surface, because, like I said,
I
it reaches so far. But again, thank you very much, John. And yes, we'll do this again.
Okay.
Thank
Keep
you.
In touch, and we'll put a lot more details in next time. I tried to give you the broad picture.
Okay. Well, thank you. Good night.
Okay. Bye-bye.